Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast, number 367. Someone, possibly by the name of Skydart, cannot be ripped away from Animal Crossing, which she ran out today to purchase.
I was on the fence about it, and then I had to get it, and now I am stuck forever.
Well, I'll tell you, I've never seen one sort of animal sell so many pairs to another sort of animal. I mean, this has really been mind-bending.
Oh my god, wait until it's winter.
No.
You don't even know what the crops are like.
I won't find out. Now I'm kind of invested.
Extreme rare picking.
I'm kind of invested. Hey, thanks if you came out to see the shows in Salt Lake City the past couple days. I'm headed off to Philly next, Helium, June 27th, 28th, and 29th. Go to nerdist.com/calendar. Also, we have our big show, the Saturday night of San Diego Comic-Con. That's a live podcast at the Balboa Theater, so check that out as well. Hey, I'd like to thank a snazzy new sponsor to the Nerdist Podcast, Hulu Plus. Right? You probably streamed Hulu, but now there's Hulu Plus, and Hulu Plus basically gives you all of everything. Hulu, you'll get a limited number of shows in the current season, but a Hulu Plus, you can binge on full seasons. You can watch all your current shows, you can watch full series runs, classic TV shows, shows like Community, or Modern Family, or South Park, or SNL, or Family Guy, or The Colbert Report. It's all for $7.99 a month at HuluPlus.com. /Nerdist, by the way, is a special promotional offer that we're extending to Nerdist Podcast listeners. You basically can get a free trial, and we'll extend it for you. Downton Abbey, Hulu Plus. Grey's Anatomy, Hulu Plus. New Girl, Hulu Plus.
This is the worst Office, rap I've ever heard Hulu in my life.
It's prose rap. I'm tired of rap. You know, look, rap is rhyme talking, but I want a prose talk.
Rhyme talking.
Yep. That is HuluPlus.com/Nerdist, all lowercase. This episode is Alex Winter, who I'm sure you know as Bill S. Preston Esquire, from, of course, Bill and Ted's. Huge Doctor Who nod in there, though, if you hadn't caught it before, of course you had. But Alex basically gave up acting in 93 and started directing, and he directed a movie that we on the podcast are huge fans of, which is called Freaked. And he's just a fantastic guy, and as you'll hear in this interview, like proto-nerd with the internet. I think Alex Winter might be the internet, I think is what we determine. But he's got a movie that he directed called Downloaded, which is a limited run in theaters on June 21st, then available on VOD July 1st. But it's essentially about the rise and fall of Napster and Sean Fanning and Sean Parker. So get it in a couple weeks when it's available. Or if it's after July 1st, then rush right now to the internet that you're probably on, the Nerdist Podcast number 367 with Alex Winter.
I got stung by bees.
None of that's real.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Fun to beat up on. When he asked for a coffee, I was so excited to get to tell Kyle to do something.
You can tell him to do stuff.
You're our guest. You can have the normal size water.
Yeah, you don't have to have a water nub.
This is basically a shot of water.
Yeah, I know. I love those teeny little things.
Okay. How do we create
it's more waste, right?
What is more waste?
Well, I think the idea behind it was like, you know, like for production, because I only ever see them on productions.
Oh,
like
the nubs? Right.
Yeah. Because like people always drink half a bottle of water and then leave it.
So you're saying that people drink more of these than those?
No, I'm saying...
And this creates more waste?
I think that's the idea behind the original production of the Yubs.
Yeah. I want to know what Alex Winter thinks about this. But where do you weigh in right now politically on the water nub?
I've given it an enormous amount of thought. And whatever that was just went clean out of my head.
Okay.
Now, I get these all the time, both when I'm shooting and just like in various places. And the funny thing, I was somewhere the other day where they were being conservative with their little nubs.
Yes.
They're like, I'm sorry, we can only give you one nub. I'm like, well, if you give me like four of them, I'll have like the equivalent of one glass of water. Just for the record, like the whole idea of like water becoming this commodity that like you can't have more of.
No.
Well, you know, the world's gone plumb Nestle. Crazy when that happens, right?
The Nestle CEO bought a shit ton of water up in Canada, and he's like, I don't think water should be free.
So I had the same thought, but I did not have the business acumen to pull it off. But I love the idea of just putting your arms around a resource and saying, screw it, I'm charging you.
Should
for
I he's direct another movie, or should I dam off all the water from humanity?
Right. Monsanto has copyrighted water.
I feel like...
Didn't Lex Luthor do that? Wasn't that like his...
Well, his plan was to basically create... It's to sink California into the water.
Right.
And then create beachfront property in Nevada.
Right. So he and the CEO of Nestle have a lot in common.
They have...
Wait, which movie was that, the plot?
That was the first
Donner.
One.
That was the first
was,
Donner
okay.
movie.
The really good one.
Superman Returns, he's just doing it again. This time he's just making continents.
Wait,
so we'd have beachfront property.
Oh, and Superman Returns?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to be sure.
But you won't have Ned Beatty running around in a pork pie hat.
No.
That's too bad.
Mr. Luthor. Hey, Mr. Luthor. Oh, Mr. Luthor.
The greatest thing in the world.
That was fantastic. And when you really think about it, maybe like a couple years after the... Oh, God damn it.
What is those?
Where they get trying to scratch himself in the air, people. Who the
Deliverance.
Oh, okay.
I'm not good at charades.
That was banjo?
I thought you were doing air guitar.
I was doing...
Like
na, 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 na,
I think you were just squeezing one of those blow-up guitars you get at a fair.
So a couple years after Deliverance, then
Mr. Luthor. Hey, Mr. Luthor.
Yeah, it was a hell of a comeback.
Still a fucking great movie, though.
Oh, the best. Both of those movies are great.
Pretty soon, water will just be the cap. You'll just get a cap, it'll be just like
$9.
Just like a hummingbird. You'll just have to
drink it at some fancy bar in Venice.
All water will be priced it's Woodstock '98.
Our water's more wet.
Well, welcome to the show, Alex.
Thank you,
sir. It's a pleasure to meet you. I was a big fan of Freaked.
Freaked
loved the
great.
Shit out of that movie.
Thank
Idiot
you.
Box.
Yeah, oh 35 God. Years later, it looks like we have a Blu-ray of Freak coming out.
No way.
No, like August 6th, I think. It just got announced yesterday.
That's great.
I've been fighting for it for decades.
Well, it'd be weird if you had a Blu-ray come out earlier.
Well,
like 20 years ago.
That would have been really cutting edge. DVDs are gone now, aren't they?
I mean, pretty much.
Yeah, so it's still a little late.
Yeah, I guess they kind of are gone. Now it's basically Blu-ray or you just...
Thumb drive.
Or thumb drive. Or you just
a company blows it your way.
Yeah.
Oh, that was great. Yeah. And then you get the experience.
Yeah, exactly.
So many things I want to talk to you about. But first, I watched Downloaded last night.
Oh, cool.
And totally fascinated by it. I mean, I knew the sort of broad strokes of Sean Fanning and Parker and the Napster thing, but I didn't really know all of the details. I didn't really know how many steps along the way it seemed like. Oh, you know, they could still pull it off, and they could make a deal with the recording.
Heartbreaking.
No, the recording industry just went in with the Iron Giant, and it turned into a giant.
Exactly.
A weapon.
I am not a gun.
Yeah.
But just that idea where it feels like the recording industry prevailed, and then they realized, like, oh, yeah, people are just going to do this anyway.
Yeah, that's right. There was a sort of head-scratching moment after the $400 million of legal fees it didn't actually stop anything anyway.
Oh, wow. the internet is...
Come back!
Yeah.
Come back!
We're just joking.
I was only kidding.
And I'm 90, and you sued me for $50,000.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, sorry. did you approach those guys about that, or did they? How did Downloaded come together?
In brief, you know, it's the rise and fall of Napster, which you know, being older than 12, which I am, I'll give that much away.
Sure.
You know, I sort of had bridged the analog to digital. It was that generation that bridged the analog to digital gap in a big way, and that I was a big Napster user. I was really big into the internet when it showed up, and for laymen in like the early 90s, I was really into BBS groups and, you know, the alt groups. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wasn't so much an IRC, but basically the beginning of social networks and communities online was really something I was interested in. And then Napster, 98, dial-up. Super slow, internet barely works, and then suddenly you have this thing that shows up that was really fast, connected you to people around the world right away, you know, file sharing, you know, chat, all the stuff that just hadn't happened before.
Yeah.
So I was a huge proponent. And then, you know, probably a month before it went offline, I was like, oh, wait a minute, is this legal?
So yeah. I can just take all this?
Yeah, it's like 90 gigabytes of hard drive space later.
But it is sort of like thinking of the idea is not so much that Napster is a music piracy service, but a really powerful indexing service.
Completely.
Which, yeah. You know, like if you strip away... the legality, but it really did change the way that that we could get files to people and share and I remember feeling like, wait, so anything, anyone, really? Yeah. Like that was the first time that I ever felt like, oh, we're all a community on the internet, was like AOL 94.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second time where I felt like, oh fuck, we really are, like there is a localized community of the world coming together, was Napster.
Yeah, that's exactly how I felt too, because for me that was the whole thing. It just blew doors open. Like suddenly everything that had been clunky, it had been promising but clunky, was suddenly really fat. Like it was the beginning of the internet being a real-time global community for me.
Yeah.
And that was much more interesting to me than the file sharing side, because we just had never had anything like that before, so it was really revolutionary. And then obviously it got shut down, and I was really taken by the story of Fanning and Parker and what they had gone through. And it wasn't just like, you know, they were heroes or something. This is before we sort of looked at internet people as heroes or villains.
Right.
You know, they were just these two kids who invented something really interesting that had a lot of, you know, complexity and legal issues around it, no doubt. Right. So there was a lot of gray area. And I just found it a really fascinating cultural story. So I met them in like 2002 and pitched them making a movie of their story in 2002. When Napster was just crumbling.
Oh, wow.
And I wrote it, and they signed on. I wrote it as a narrative for MTV. I was going to do it, to direct it there. And then they stopped making it. It was like chasing the tsunami, like, you know, as reality TV was like destroying everything. You know, they stopped making movies altogether. Then I sold it to Paramount, and they stopped, MTV Films started making movies. And I walked away from it in like 04, 05. And then like in 09, I was just kind of freaked out by how much divisiveness there still was in the internet community. Like I figured that all these issues would have gotten solved. Like surely once Steve Jobs came along and said, no, people aren't thieves, they want to buy content, really, and everyone did. I figured a lot of this stuff was going to go away. And yet in 2009, it was like right before SOPA and all this stuff, everything was getting more heated.
Yeah.
And more fractious and more divisive. And nobody seemed to know what the hell was going on and who were the good guys and who were the bad guys. And, you know, Bradley Manning's a hero. No, he's the Antichrist. No, we have to like stop everyone from using the internet. No, we need to be more free with the internet. And I was like, all right, I met everybody. I knew all the players on the label side, the tech side and all that. I thought, why don't I just get out of the way and make it a doc instead of a narrative and mm-hmm. let them just tell the story themselves? And that's why I went back to the story so many years later. And that's how it came out as a doc.
It's really fun. It's funny. It's funny to watch Sean Fanning's family, who is these like, hey, these Boston guys. You know,
totally.
His brother's like,
yeah.
And all these guys are coming over and they're camping on a floor.
Yeah.
And then you cut to Sean Fanning, yeah. And he's the most articulate. Like, where did he? How did? Like, he doesn't even.
Yeah, he's anomalous. I mean, he's an anomalous human being. I mean, you are dealing with, that's the thing that I love about the Napster stories. Whether you agree with what they did or not, you know, they are two of the most interesting individuals I've ever met, by far.
And Sean Parker looks, I love the idea that they like, that must have been good for his ego. They're like, oh, they got Justin Timberlake to play me in the Facebook movie?
Yeah.
You see him like, okay, well, they're both white guys.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know. I mean, that was the first, when I first showed Parker, I've known those guys a long time, when I first showed him any of the movie, you know, the only thing he reacted to was like, oh, Christ, look at my hair. You know? These sort of like 90s, like, you know, streak tips hair, yep. And, you know, bobbleneck. So they were 17 years old. They were kids.
Oh my God! What was the first? What was your biggest discovery on Napster when you first started? When you realized, like, oh shit, I could totally. What did you start downloading?
Well, everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For me, I wasn't even so much. It, you know,
That's actually not true.
I can't remember which guy said it in the OTF interviews, but there was one guy that was like, "Yeah, but the one of the powerful things was to get things that you were just not commercially available."
That was Larry Lessig. That's actually how I approached it, because I already had my music collection.
Right.
I'd already been around long enough to have been suckered into buying vinyl and then everything again on cassette and then everything again on CD.
Yeah.
So I had my record collection four times over by the time Napster showed up. So yeah. I was mostly using it to get like rare jazz bootlegs.
Right.
When it first showed up, that's what I used it for global community, because I was like being into like the alt-rec BBSs in those days. Mm-hmm. So I was using the internet to find music that way. Then you would go buy it, but someone would be like, "Oh, you like Coltrane, why don't you check out this trumpet player from blah blah blah, go buy this." And so immediately I was making friends in Japan, Germany, Finland, who were turning me on to all this stuff I'd never heard of. In fact, I was directing a lot of music videos in those days, and I remember going to Columbia Records on a music video I was shooting. And one of the heads of Columbia Records came in because he heard I was working on the Napster store. I thought he was going to kick me out of the building. This is like 02. And he was like, "No, I love Napster." I was like, "Why?" He's like, "Because we've been missing a whole chunk of the Coltrane archive here at Columbia, and they found it on a guy's hard drive in Japan."
Shit.
Oh, like,
wow.
Really high quality stuff. And they were able to round out their own, like Columbia's own Coltrane archive using
Napster. Well, they sued it out of him, right?
Well, yeah. No, that guy's in jail now.
Yeah, of course.
He's next door to Bradley Manning.
The important thing is they got the music.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. They got it back.
They brought it back to the conglomerates that own it.
That's right.
Have the rights to it.
Yeah. Yeah. And they extracted whatever was left out of Alice Coltrane's like bank account.
God, I would go in there and just search, you know, I would get these weird, like, you know, Radiohead covered The Spy Who Loved Me and at a live show, and someone, like, I would just enter covers in the search field and just get the most amazing.
I remember like doing dumb stuff, like, you know, finding the 25 different versions of For What It's Worth, the Buffalo Springfield song. There's like a Barbershop Quartet version, a Willie Nelson version, a Rasta version,
the Candy Skins covered it.
Seriously. Yeah. It's like, and you'd have like Drive like really whacked out, but in those days, it's really, there's nothing like Napster anymore, so it's hard to describe for people who weren't around then that you could type in anything,
right,
and it would show up, and it didn't matter if it was a Madonna single or something just insanely rare, like, you know, throat singers from the Ukraine.
Sure,
you would get it in like droves.
Well, now it's basically like torrent sites and like Pirate Bay and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. Which is a little harder to search, because no matter what you type in, you get porn.
Yeah,
right. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
I know that most of the time you're typing in porn, but on the occasion that you're not, you still just get porn.
If you put in throat singer, you're gonna get
you're gonna get porn. Yeah, that's true. That's why that keeps happening.
That's probably what he's talking.
But the throat singer porn is actually pretty valuable.
It's not bad, because they can sing at the same time.
Yeah,
that's what's surprising about it. Yeah,
yeah. And the Eastern European ones are pretty interesting. Anyway, where were we?
One part of the... no, I want to keep going down this road. But
that's what he said?
Oh, you mixed it up a little bit.
And I felt dirty.
Gender bent it. So when you first started digging around online, did people have any idea that you were you?
Maybe that was another thing that I liked about it. Fanning talks about the anonymity of the internet, which, of course, is long gone. There's no anonymity anywhere in the world anymore.
Except for trolls.
Yeah. Yeah. The bastard. But the anonymity of it was cool, was that you could sort of just be another person, you know, and your interests. Sean talks about this in the movie. Your interests were what validated you online, not anything else about who you were.
Yeah.
And that was appealing. But that would have been appealing to me personally, whether I was a quasi-celebrity or not, because it's just kind of my nature. And that's something that Fanning and I connected on, was like the idea that global community could be something where, you know, social standing, class, all that stuff would just get wiped away. And it was just about what you were about.
Yeah.
The early days of the net was all about that, which is really interesting.
When did you first go online?
I would say 89, 90, somewhere in there.
Oh, wow. That's early. I thought I was pretty badass at like 93.
But 93 is pretty early. But in the early, I remember in like around 90, I started getting into news groups and connecting to people that way. And then you could also, because I was directing at that time, you could use it to, like, the internet was a really great research resource even back then.
Right.
So I would use it to like move. like QuickTime files if I was working on effects or something like that. We started using it for that stuff right away.
How long did that take?
Dude, it was it's laughable. Like what we would do, like to move like a, you know, like 143K file, which was like barely visible, or you'd have your real player window up, and it was like this. I used those in the movie. The movie has a lot of ugly aesthetic on purpose because the internet was really ugly back then.
Yeah.
And in the early 90s, it was crazy ugly because it was just this gummy blob, and you would be like, wow, look at that. a gummy blob.
I mean, the transfer rates were in like baud.
Well, I remember like trying to download a 10.9 megabyte file and like starting it at night, getting up in the morning for school and going, not ready yet.
Oh, yeah. The whole world was like that. If you were working on like NFX or something, if we were doing music videos or whatever, if you'd render some tiny little stupid effect on like a guitar player, like I want to put some some gravel effect in his guitar. It's like, okay, you hit render and you leave for 3 days.
Yeah.
You know, you come back.
You really had to schedule your masturbation time.
Oh, totally.
Because you would go, okay, I'll start downloading in the morning, then I'll have dinner, and then at about 8 o'clock, I'll be ready to go.
I can't wait. Yeah. And it's the wrong file, and it's broken anyway.
No! But if you got
just enough of it, that was the thing.
I think that's Areola.
Yeah. All right, back to scrambled porn on television.
It's just the Mr. Hand video again.
Yeah. Oh. Some of this is Jenna Jameson, some is Steven Seagal, but I'm going to go with it anyway. It's taken me 9 hours.
Yeah. As long as he doesn't talk, it's all right.
I see
a ponytail, so it could go either way.
Ironically, his tits are bigger now.
Hey, good. That's awesome.
Put it on the board, Matt.
Yeah, and even in such a ridiculously short period of time now. I mean, like, watching Sean Parker say in maybe 2000, or maybe it was even like 99, when he said, someday, you know, people will get their music on their phones. Like, this is all going to be ubiquitous. And and it was, you know, that was pretty amazing to hear that.
That's really the quote. I mean, even Parker was completely gobsmacked when he saw that quote. I played that at South by Southwest the year before last when we first showed a piece of the movie, and that was the first the first that Parker and Fanning saw of the movie was that clip. And it's pretty astounding because in 98 he basically lays out the world that we're living in today before iPhones, iPads, iTunes, anything. And he's 19 years old, and he barely knows what the hell he's talking about. You know?
But you can tell when you hear these guys talk. They're I think one of my favorite, I'm going to call him characters, in the movie was the Nutella guy.
Oh, Gene, he's the best. Gene Kamm is the best.
Who is when Fanning's saying, or someone is saying, like, no one expected him to basically lay out this assault, or maybe it was Fanning against that Senate subcommittee hearing. Yeah. And all of his words are very much like, you're all going down in flame.
Yeah. But he talks very fast like this and in this monotone voice.
And so it's almost like hearing a machine get really passionate.
Exactly. Yeah.
But he never changes the tone of his voice.
I know. It's amazing.
And there's no punctuation in his sentence.
Yeah. He just proclaims the apocalypse in this really even tone and then walks away. And of course, he was 100% correct.
Yeah.
He's that guy. He was the Mac Daddy. He was an amazing dude.
But all those guys, like it all, you know, do you feel like the film, do you feel like it's balanced in the sense that do you go, well, look, these are all this is what happened as well as I could put it together. And you guys decide whatever you think is right or wrong. Or do you feel like the film kind of has a point of view?
I mean, I really tried to not create too much of a point of view because, you know, my opinion has honestly changed so many times. Like one person's opinion, whether they admit it or not, changes a lot.
Yeah.
You know, so I didn't want to be like, I did not want to be the arbiter for the digital revolution. I don't really want that responsibility.
Right.
Thank you very much. But I also, because I, you know, grew up making music videos and, you know, being involved with a lot of bands and stuff, I had a lot of sympathy for the record industry and a lot of really close friends in the record industry. And the thing that I wanted to show with the movie that was, you know, some people call it even-handed or whatever, but for me, it's really simple. Innovation comes and evolutionarily, meaning it's going to come in waves, right? So, like, Fanning and Parker are like the Mottola of their day.
Sure.
Like, Donny Einer, Seymour Stein, and Chris Blackwell, who were the three label guys I focused on, were the geniuses in their, you know, late teens, early 20s, and did incredible things to create the record industry that we have today. So there's a lot of, very much so, Parker and Fanning are going to be the establishment that are being overturned in 10 to 20, well, the way war works now could be 5 months from now, but you know what I mean? So, like, I just kind of wanted to show that innovation happens and it impacts people And it doesn't mean that, I mean, I think it's wrong. One thing I will say, and I try to show this, I think it is, Lessig makes his point really well, and so does Barlow. I think it's wrong to villainize a generation, you know, for using technology the way that it's there to use. And you can't personify technological revolution. You can't say, it's all Sean Parker's fault that we doubt. It's like, no, you know, this is the way technology was moving. It would have been someone else if it wasn't him. This is the world we live in.
Right.
And everyone gets uprooted by innovation. They always do. I mean, yeah. So it's unfair to, like, you know, to criminalize our kids today and, like, brand them all as pirates when mostly they're just like, oh, this is really cool. If you come up with a way for me to pay for this, I'll totally use it. Well, otherwise, I'm going to do it the other way.
It's kind of fun to watch, like, the Ninth Circuit Court judge, who I gave a lot of credit to for being pretty savvy, but saying to the recording industry guy, wait, so these Napster's not storing any of the music. They're not touching any of it. And the guy was like, well, no, but I mean, but this music is being pirated. And he was like, yeah, but they're not.
Yeah.
He goes, it's user to user, right?
Yeah.
Yes, but, you know, and so and just trying, it was clear, like, basically, they were trying to punch a ghost. Or they were trying to punch a cloud.
Yeah.
It's like they were angry that this thing was happening, that these guys had sort of facilitated this revolution. But from, you know, from a legal standpoint, they weren't sharing any of the music. They were just connecting people to share music one another.
Yeah, they just, I mean, the labels, you know, on a certain level, and you understand why, they just wanted the whole damn internet to go away. I mean, really, if you boil down their legal defense, that was it. Just please go away. All you internet stuff.
Yeah.
And I think we still live with some of that. I think we still live with a lot of ignorance about how these technologies work and the way that people, not to say you shouldn't legislate and you shouldn't create a monetizable system that doesn't, you know, artists need to get compensated. That's a really, really important issue today, right? But you can't legislate technology away. It's impossible.
But even a lot of the you know, even a lot of the artists who were in the traditional model still didn't make, you know, like, they still didn't make money from a single.
You're right. The percentage is, I mean, no matter what you want to say, the record industry stood to lose a lot of money in terms of the difference between the way they made money off CDs and the way they were going to make money off the $1 single, though they're beginning to figure that out now. The artists, percentage-wise, have always, the percent of artists that makes money, a lot of money making music, hasn't really changed. It's always been a very small percentage. It wasn't like before Napster, if you were a musician, you were going to get really rich.
Right.
No matter what. Yeah. You know, it just wasn't, there was always a very small percentage you made it.
Because if you got an advance, then a lot of times you spent a good portion of your life paying that
you
back.
Were an indentured servant.
You really were. And so I still think some form of that model is still intact, which is, you know, people find out about, I mean, that's the basis of what we do here was founded in that, which is, hey, the show's free. If we perform live, come see us. And then that supports the show, which is where, you know, and before, the artists were like, oh, well, the label is helping facilitate getting it in front of people on the limited channels that were available.
Yeah.
But now we can just go straight to people and go, here's a free thing. Come see us live.
Yeah, the intermediary being sort of squeezed out of the process, which they don't need to be. There's plenty of room for them once they understand how to work within the new paradigm. You know, that's the big seismic shift, right? Suddenly the internet democratized everything and everyone just went, oh, crap. You know, what are we going to do? From the government to the record industry, the movie industry, everyone just, like, had a complete panic attack.
Right.
And they're still having a panic attack.
I mean, literally across every sector.
Yeah. I mean, it's mass panic. You know, it's certainly not gotten more calm. It's gotten less. I mean, that was the one thing people asked me, like, you know, what did you learn making the movie since you'd been around the story for so long? I think the one thing that was surprising to me was how completely pissed off everybody still was. And also how little a lot of people had learned in the intervening years.
Well, I'm sure you're going to, and you may have gotten this question a bunch, but I just imagine, like, some slick reporter who thinks he's going to nail you. All right, Alex, tell me this. What if someone downloaded this movie for free?
Every frickin' Q&A. Yeah. There's always that. I call him that guy.
And I think they're expecting you to be like,
oh, no, what am I going to? Oh,
well, that's not okay.
Yeah.
Hey, the press conference is over.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Flip the entire long table.
There's always some smirking a-hole in the back of every Q&A that I've done, and I've done many, who's like,
It's like young Frankenstein.
Where can I download this for free? Yeah.
But Mr. Frankenstein, isn't it
intro.
Isn't it true? Yeah. It's pronounced Frankenstein.
Yeah. And then I hit them with like a 40-minute answer about Creative Commons law, which bores the shit out of them, and then I never get that question again. Because like we don't live in 2003 anymore. It's like, yes, this movie will be streaming. Yes, you'll be able to effectively get it for free, but guess what? There will be ad revenue and people will be paid back, and they're just like, oh, why did I ask that question?
I mean,
we don't live in that world anymore. The torrenting community is a fraction of the consumer community in this day.
And I really do feel that if people are a fan of something, that they, I think there is a little something about humanity that you feel a little weird just taking stuff for free. I mean, maybe disposable stuff where you're like, oh, I'll just download that because it's there. But, you know, like when we do shows, people bring us things. People offer to pay for episodes a lot of the time because they want to. And we're like, no, you don't. It's totally fine. You don't have to do that. So I really do believe that by and large, if people are fans of something, I know I will choose the pay option when I have it to support, you know. And I really feel like that I mean, I think good does sort of bubble up in that instance.
Without it, I mean, look, you know, there's a lot of people that don't agree with this, but from my perspective as a downloader and as someone who used those services, like what I saw happening in 2002, I remember saying this to Fanny when I met him, when everyone was saying branding them as pirates. It was like, you guys just created an incredibly convenient service. The consumer is always going to use the most convenient service.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean the consumer are thieves. That was the thing that I think a lot of people on the other side never got. And that's the thing that Steve Jobs always got, which is the reason he was able to swoop in and claim 85% market share for all downloadable music, because he knew the consumer wasn't inherently thieves. He knew that they would pay for convenience. You give them something that's as cool as a thing that they're getting for free, and guess what? They're going to pay for it.
I do miss my Winamp skins.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can still get those.
Yeah, but you can make those now. For those sort of retro guys like us, you know.
Yeah. I'm sure there's a Flash site you can just do.
Yeah. That. I still watch everything on my real player.
It's like, wow. Yeah.
That installer still launches every time.
I go on to Netscape.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I think it's all starting to monetize. People are starting to get with the program. There's just a lot of anger that I think, frankly, at the end of the day, that the people, without any oversight from the business or the government communities, were able to come in and do this without anybody being able to stop.
Well, what's you know, I think what artists have to remember is that while, you know, this, like you said, democratized everything, and so we as artists are more empowered, I think what some people maybe don't realize is that the well, good or bad, depending on how you look at it, but what comes with that is the responsibility as the artist to basically do the same job that a label would do or a promotional machine. Is it's now it's on you as the artist to, like, all right, hey, if you want this power, great, but now you have all this responsibility. So you know, it's kind of a pain in the ass, but you know, but then you'll get your, you know, you get to own your own stuff.
Yeah. Or the labels also, you know, really beginning to step up to the plate and figure out ways to work with the internet, which they have, so that artists can get support and use the internet. I think someone like Adele is a really good example of that, like, you know, where the music is good, they did kind of come out of nowhere. Then they sort of got help from the label. Then they really broke. I think there's really, it doesn't have to be so divided. I mean, that's the thing that seemed obvious to me back then, was like, why, you know, it sounds very, you know, tree huggery, but like, why don't you guys just all like work together,
right?
You know, and like create a system together moving forward, and it actually can work for everyone, because art labels are, to their credit, really good at artist development. They are. They always have been. They can screw artists. They can also be really good at developing artists. Like, yeah. I don't think we would have had Bob Dylan without the support that he had Bruce Springsteen. You think about some of the really biggest artists that seem so independent, and they always had this massive artillery behind them that was really good at crafting them through all of the BS they had to get through.
Well, it's just now there's so many channels.
It's a garbage dump, dude. Oh my God. I mean, I got kids, you know, and my 14-year-old's like, I don't know what to listen to. I'm just like, he ends up gravitating towards older good stuff because he knows it's good.
Yeah.
He doesn't listen to anything post late. Like, he's always listening to Nirvana. Like, that's like as new as it gets for him. And I'm just like, have you not heard of anything post like 1995? You know, he's like, yeah, but this is classic. This is great. He doesn't know.
Classic.
Nirvana's classic. Rock,
dude.
It's classic rock.
It's sad but true, but it's like, he doesn't,
sad but true, classic rock.
I mean, kind of what you guys do. It's like, it's, we're getting into this world now where people are beginning to curate.
Yeah,
where, like, you know, you like to go here or to go to this place or that place to get some, your arms around this like catawall of crap that's out there.
Yeah, I'm just worried. I mean, like, I do appreciate the idea, and of course, as someone who loves technology, I do.
I do appreciate the idea of the algorithmic recommendation engine, but part of it makes me sad because I feel like, oh, but they're just telling you stuff that they know you would probably like, and you're missing that human component of someone going, hey, here's something you probably never would have listened to that is so far out there, but you should totally listen to this.
Well, yeah. what I don't like about the algorithm thing, just like if you like this, then this. It's mechanical. All it is just kind of breaking down the aspects of it. It's like it's this fuzzy, it's this screamy, it's this quiet, it's this pretty, you know. But it doesn't like, you know, but bands like that I listen to don't often sound the same.
Yeah.
Sometimes they do. And that's what I always enjoyed about MySpace Music when it kind of became a thing, is that you would have a band that you liked. You would go listen, you'd go to their page, and then you would have there where they have the top eight. And these weren't bands that sounded like them. These are bands that they also liked and had a similar like aesthetic and style that didn't necessarily mean music. And that's what's missing. That's the human element, I think, that's missing.
But
from
that's
a lot
like
of stuff.
I think there's a lot of stuff that's really short transitional stuff that we're living in. Like, you know, Neil Young there's a bunch of artists that are out there really griping about the sound quality of downloading, which is like such a blip in the radar of history, right? Because I mean, around the corner is going to be wave file sized music tracks that your average Joe can has a big enough broadband to pull down very quickly, and it'll sound way better than a CD ever sounded. That's around the corner. I mean, I think that a lot of these new services like Spotify that are imperfect, but certainly way better than what we had before, are beginning to create ways for artists to interact directly. Like, what's so cool once it works is artists can interact directly with their fans in a way they never could before. So you can, the curation models that are coming, I think, are going to be amazing. Like, once that starts to get built into the architecture of the net more and people really get more accustomed to using it.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I have so much more interaction with my fan base. That's like what helped us get like, you know, the Freak re-released, or like all the stuff that we've done has been done like a lot of times with our fans. You know, back in the day, it was just you were in a vacuum and you never had any interaction with anybody, and you just kind of guess your way through it. And I do like that side.
Yeah, that's what I like about Bandcamp. I think that's one of the better music sites coming up, is that, you know, bands could just start their own page. You can stream whatever they put up there, and then you have the option to buy it. But then on top of that, when you buy it, they get your email, and they could easily just send you an email going, thanks for buying our stuff. And then you kind of, there's a more of a personal interaction with it. And they also have links to like bands they think you should check out if you like their stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
I think Bandcamp is the one that's going to be kind of popping up if they just kind of get a better
UI.
On
Bandcamp, can you build... can you build like a homepage for yourself and like, here's a bunch of music that I'm listening to, and can people follow you and see?
No, that's
you're...
the thing about the UI. Is I think it needs to be
because that's
like
that RDO
element. Friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, that's what I love about RDO.
Right.
And RDO is like, and that's the thing. It's a streaming service that's helped me buy more music. If I really like something I'm listening to on RDO that I found, I go and I get the record on vinyl.
Right.
You know, it's like I think all this streaming stuff is going to actually help people buy more.
I have all of them. I do tend to fall back on Pandora a lot because I feel like it's the simplest.
Mm-hmm.
Spotify I like, but there are so many different elements. It's like, oh, well, you can search one song, but then you can just listen to that song. Well, then you can build a station around this, but then you can, like,
yeah.
It's like there are a lot of options with Spotify, which obviously it's probably good for the consumer. But at the same time, when you're sort of in the hurry, you just want to like, oh, I just want to hit it, you know.
Yeah. For me, I like Pandora and Spotify the best. And for Spotify, maybe because I'm used to the old way of music, it's just like I want to be able to pull an album down.
Yeah.
And I like being able to go, okay, here's the whole thing. Wham, send it across. Now I've just got that in my playlist and I'm done. And I can use it both as like a single music service or a radio or like for whole albums. It tends to work that way. The thing that I miss is curation. You know, I missed exactly what you were saying. I missed the fact that I'd like to, I'm not going to get turned on to new music by a bot. It hardly ever happens. It's like, you know, if you build, you know, just to use a really obtuse example, if you build like a Smiths channel because you want to hear some old stuff and you do that as radio, it's like they're gonna give you that and The Cure and that and The Cure and that and The Cure and that and The Cure until you want to blow your head off.
Well, maybe some of Morrissey's solo work.
Yeah, exactly. But it's like, it's so like completely arbitrary and annoying. It just becomes annoying, frankly.
Yeah.
I mean, I want someone to come on and go, no, check this out. This is like left of center, but at least tangentially.
It does take some of the magic out of it when they're like, it's a little bit of midichlorians when they're like, you chose this song because it has dark tones and starts on the downbeat and has a four count. You know, you're like, oh, I don't want to know all that.
Exactly. These lyrics suck. This guy is the worst.
Right.
It's like there's something to, you know, just, you know, like when... when like Nirvana came out, then like you read an interview of Kurt Cobain and he's like, he just says the Melvins, Black Flag, and you right. go, well, now I want to know about those bands. They don't right. sound like Nirvana, but like yeah. you want to go and check them out. Totally. That's the same thing about going to a record store. You're buying something. Guys like, oh, you like these guys? Well, mm-hmm. you got to check out this band.
Yeah,
like, these are the guys that came before
and
them.
And old labels like SST or some of the original yeah. labels that were, you know, had a pretty varied, you know, selection of music, but it all fit within some kind of window, but you wouldn't necessarily draw those
exactly.
parallels.
Exactly, yeah, Black Flag to Lemonheads or right. something like that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Where did you, what did you want to do, be an actor first, or did you want to be a director first? Or
no, director, really. I mean, I started acting, I was a child actor, so I was on Broadway all through my, and commercials and stuff all through my childhood. I started acting when I was 10. I got my SAG card when I was 10. So, but I always wanted to just make films, so I went to NYU film school after doing all of that. Like, I've quit acting like 5 times in my life. You know, I've had like, you know, I literally stopped acting for good when I was 16 the
yeah.
first time.
Yeah.
And then I went to film school. I went to NYU, and I came out of NYU, and I moved to LA to make movies. And you know, I was like 20, and so I was totally broke and yeah. in debt up to my butt. And so I, you know, I still had a manager and agent. I was like, can I go on some auditions because I'm broke? And then I booked like Lost Boys and Bill and Ted's like back to back.
This is easy.
And I was like living in this crappy apartment in Venice with my roommate from NYU who was like, he was like delivering pizza and I was like doing Lost Boys.
Yeah. Jesus.
And yeah, that was Tom Stern, and we made The Idiot Box and Freak together and all that stuff. So well, like, so even in those acting days, I really was mostly shooting. Like I would go, I never really had a Hollywood lifestyle. I always had like this kind of indie filmmaker lifestyle. I would go home from the set and like, you know, we had a Steenbeck in our apartment and we were like making short movies and music videos. And as soon as I could pay my rent without acting, I stopped acting. So I stopped acting.
Oh, wow.
I stopped acting professionally in 93.
Wow. Hmm. Well, I know that a lot of times, you know, because we are Lost Boys and Bill and Ted's fans, sometimes it was like to go up to Santa Cruz for those big saxophone rock concerts. That,
yeah, and like oil down your chest.
Yeah. All the kids.
Yeah. Every summer I go and see him.
Yeah. Well, that Lost Boys is one of the first sort of documentary,
yep.
you know, feature films really? About the youth movement,
yeah.
the youth of the day.
You know, exactly.
Who loved eating maggots.
Yeah.
And
had hair extensions and wore yeah. chaps. Yeah. And had like plastic squids coming off their skull. I mean, there was a lot, yeah. you know, a lot. It was a very method movie for us. We just kind of brought a lot of ourselves,
yeah.
you know.
A lot of young men had yeah. Rob Lowe posters in their room.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
It was very accurate to yeah. what we were all doing yeah. at the time.
Comic yeah. book store at the boardwalk makes total sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Right next to the bumper cars. I see it every day.
Yeah, yeah. That was good.
I mean, you know, like, well, obviously, Lost Boys was great. I mean, you know, Bill and Ted's is one of those movies that, like, when I saw it, I was just exactly the right age for it. I'm like, oh my God, you know. And then it wasn't until a bit later where I completely appreciated on the second level for the Doctor Who connection.
Yeah.
Which obviously, because I think Ed Solomon and Chris Matheson.
Yep, that's very well done.
I believe that they were, I went to UCLA and I was in mm-hmm. this thing called the UCLA Comedy Club, which
right.
was a group of stand-up comedians.
Yeah.
And I think Chris and Ed maybe were.
They did, yes.
They were like a few years prior.
Mm-hmm.
So they were the guys that sort of came out and then like they fucking wrote Bill and Ted's.
Yeah, and it grew out of that comedy group because Bill and Ted started as a stand-up routine that Chris and Ed used to do at college, at UCLA.
Oh, shit. That I did not know.
Yeah, and they played Bill and Ted, and then they would sort of tour around playing the characters, and then they wrote a script riffing off of it, and then we made the movie. So it was it grew out of I think that's one of the things people ask me all the time, like why people still like the movies, like what makes a movie stand the test of time, and nobody knows, obviously. But like the one thing with those movies that I think stands, you know, gives it some longevity is that it was written by two really close friends. And it's played by two really close friends, and there's like a genuine camaraderie to it that has a kind of infectious quality because it's sincere.
Yeah.
And none of us thought the films were going to go anywhere at all. Like they weren't some big studio movies; they were both independent movies. Neither,
no,
you know. So,
and I would imagine most of the stuff you're shooting, where you're like, who is going to watch this ridiculousness?
Totally. Yeah, completely. Mm-hmm. So they were enormous amounts of fun for that reason because they were just like everybody we were all really good friends, and we just kind of like did whatever the hell we wanted, and there were literally less than no expectations. Expectations about where it was going. So,
yeah, kids, lower your expectations.
That's it.
Well, I think it's okay to lower your expectations as long as you're having fun. Yeah, as long as you're having. So, Was it a pretty formal audition process, or did you?
It was a crazy. It was like auditioning for the Olympics. Like I'd been around a long time by then. But like the reason Keanu and I became such good friends was that it took so freaking long for us to get cast.
Yeah.
That we were like bonded at the hip.
Oh, so you guys were just auditioning together.
Auditioning, and we were paired off with like every other actor, and it just went on for months. And then like it was ridiculous. And then like the last audition was like. It was sort of like the, I don't know if you ever saw the movie, They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
Oh, right.
It was kind of like, you know, dancing in the marathons during the Depression. Like, the last audition was like 13 hours long, and they literally brought everyone in, and they would let them go as they realized they weren't going to be Bill or Ted.
Oh.
And I was like, what the fuck is this, guys? God. And like, by like 2 in the morning, it was like me and Reeves were like kind of like wobbling on our legs. Like,
I'm excellent. Awesome, dude.
Doodle-a-doodle-a-doodle.
You got the jobs because you were the last one standing.
We were the last men standing. That was it.
Well, I guess we cut everyone else. Yeah. Well, we start shooting tomorrow.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I wonder who they're casting. It's like, if they'd have cast someone else by then, it just would have been cruel and unusual punishment.
But it, my best friend from high school actually storyboarded Bogus Journey, which when he was working on it, he had this placard in his, because I went to college and he didn't go to college, and ended up becoming like one of the biggest storyboard artists in the film industry, and that was one of his first movies. And I remember there was a placard on his car that was Bill and Ted Go to Hell.
Yeah, that was
and
our
then,
title for
and
years.
Then they made him, then at the last minute they're like, nah, you can't say
no,
go
they
to
changed
hell.
It from Bill and Ted Go to Hell to Bill and Ted's BJ, which I thought was awesome. And believe me, we understood that when we changed the title. So.
And then he was pointing out all these Easter eggs, like when when they're having the seance, and it's, I think that's Ed and Chris.
It
in
is,
there.
Yeah, yeah.
And like Denomalos is Ed Solomon's name backwards.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. And then one of the chants, I think, was some their names or something, something weird like
that.
Yeah,
that's all right. Yep. Oh, yeah, there's a ton of crazy stuff in that movie.
It wasn't like stationed. It just came out of like a delirious like rewrite or something like that.
Yeah, that was one of the biggest. I mean, these are really close friends of mine. This was one of the biggest disputes we ever had. Was like, I remember reading the script for the first time, and it was great. We put a lot of work into it, and then Coleman just like, guys, station isn't funny. It's just like there are words that if you repeat them enough are funny.
Yeah.
Station is not one of them. and then I remember Ed, I don't remember whether it was recently or a while ago, was like, you know, you were right about station, but I wasn't right about station. People love station.
It's
like
weird.
I get more people coming up to me telling me how much they love. There's like bands named station. So I was completely wrong. But luckily I wasn't one of those actors who was like, I'm not doing this and change that. You take that name station out. I'm not showing up.
Those little butt aliens.
Yeah.
They're going to fucking do that. Was the second one as much as fun as the first one?
Yeah, it was because there was a little bit of validation because the first one had come out and, you know, We had a lot more not creative control. It's not like we didn't have it on the first one, but it was just like let's just make the weirdest, most far out possible sequel we can. That was kind of our. It wasn't like let's be safe and like see if we can make a Back to the Future franchise. Like let's blow this shit up.
Sure.
let's just like stick dynamite in it and explode it.
Because at that point, people with a few major exceptions, people weren't really doing trilogies.
Yeah.
I mean, like with the, you know, obviously with like Godfather and Star Wars. I mean, like there were trilogies, but it wasn't like now. Studios do think in trilogies.
Oh, completely. Yeah. There wasn't a franchise mentality in those days. And it wasn't like, it was before actors were being paid $50 million a movie. So it was like, we got paid $5 for the first one and we got like $5.75 for the second one.
Nice bump.
It was, we fought hard for that.
Nice.
But I did walk away a couple times. But, the reality of it was that we just all went into it going, let's just make something nuts. Let's just go nuts. And so, yeah, it was enormous fun. And then also, you know, having Billy Sadler's death and just like getting to set for that sequence and watching him do his thing. It was like, we all were like, shit, why didn't we write the whole movie about this guy?
That's like, a great character.
Yeah, he's so good.
And he was great in it, but like really great. Like Joss Ackland was fucking awesome too.
Yeah, he hated every minute of it, but he was great.
Because he had come off Lethal Weapon 2.
And he was like this big Shakespeare actor. I mean, he was just miserable.
And
he
being
was,
in these weird future
platform
clothes.
Shoes. Yeah. And, yeah. I mean, it was all a blast, you know, and not being able to play ourselves as villains was fun. It was great.
Yeah,
it was great.
And so are there
is there going to be, I keep hearing, like, there is going to be another one. It's going to be those guys. No, it's going to be new guys. No, it's not happening now. Like, I always feel like I hear, it's always in some stage of a cycle of, it's happening, no, it's not happening.
Yeah, well, I mean, here's the reality of it. It's just like, we kicked the idea around for a long time. We always kick ideas. Like, that's sort of how the whole thing came about, even for Chris and Ned. It was just like wacky ideas that they kicked around that then became a movie. Then the second one was suddenly, now they were stuck with me and Reeves, and the four of us were kicking shit around, and that became the second movie. And for like the last 20 years, like whenever we're hanging out, we just kick ideas around. And then eventually we just hit one that we all thought was, we were like, oh, we should actually do this. This is great. And so we came up with a story. They went off and started working on a script. And then that kind of got leaked, which is fair enough. And like, and so we had to start talking about it because it's like
downloaded.
Yeah. The internet being what it is, it's like you kind of are damned if you do, damned if you don't. It's sure. Like, it's like if you say nothing, then the trolls just like destroy you.
Yeah.
It's like, we know this is happening. You're a scumbag. Why would you, you know? And then if you say something, they're like, yeah, but it's not happening. So why did you say something? And it's not, I'm just like, oh, whatever, guys. So
come on.
You know, it's like, so you can't really do anything other than just induct people into the tedium that is getting a movie made.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it's like the yes, no, up, down. That's welcome to show business. That's how it works.
Yeah.
So it's like, we're, you know, downloaded took me 11 years to get made. So now you're stuck on the ride with us for Bill and Ted 3. You asked for it. Now you're on the ride. So sit back and enjoy the ride. Yeah, that's right. It goes up, it goes down. We're making it, then we're not. It's these guys, then it's those guys. Welcome to the movie business.
Maybe
we'll make it one day.
Is
hopefully.
It attached to a studio or is it just the development?
It's just, we're just developing it on our own. You know, we have a blessing from the studio that owns it to develop it, and if we can put all the ducks in a row in a way that everyone loves it, we will get it made. And that's all there is to it. Other than that, we're working on it, but it is a phenomenal script. The guy, I mean, Chris Ned wrote it. It's amazing. And if at some point we can't get it made, I will upload the PDF to the internet. So
are you going to direct it if it goes?
No, I don't want to direct it. I mean, we bandied that about, but like, I know this sounds ludicrous, but it's actually, it's not terribly easy playing Bill because he's in every single scene. You know what I mean? Yeah. One thing I learned about on Freaked, even though I didn't direct that by myself, Tom Stern had enormous amount of work to do and he's a brilliant director. But even co-directing Freaked was like, almost killed me and I was 25. You know, yeah. And that was, you know, more than 2 or 3 months ago.
Well, plus he had so much prosthetics on too.
Well, it was like 4 hours in, 2 hours out every day. And there's a lot of prosthetics in this one if we make it. So it's I can't. There's just no way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I want to know about like when you guys, how it came about that you got to do a sketch show for MTV like with Tom.
Oh, really?
I worked with Tom twice. I wrote on the Annie Milonaka show, season 2, and then I was a couple of the Mole Men and Saul of the Mole Men.
Oh, I did one of those voices.
Yeah,
too.
You were the
King
of the Mole Men.
Yeah.
I was Clancy.
Clancy.
Not
that
the
was
voice,
great.
Just the body.
All right.
Yeah, yeah.
Sweet. So me and Stern, we went to NYU together, and we made a bunch of short films together, and we hooked up with Sam Raimi when we came out of NYU based on our senior project, this crazy movie called Squeal of Death. And Sam and his partner tried to get movies off the ground for us, and nobody was interested. And we made very, very weird, irreverent stuff. And this was pre-South Park and Tim Burton and all this. So there was just no room in the marketplace. Everyone looked at us like we were space aliens. And Bill and Ted did well. And MTV called me into their offices. And I'd done a bunch of stuff for MTV for years, like, you know, off-site type film stuff. And they were like, do you want to guest VJ as Bill? And I was like, hell no. I can't imagine anything worse, frankly. But thank you for asking me for a job. And how about, we've got this script that Sam Raimi's been trying to get made with no luck. It was an anthology comedy that nobody was interested in. So we converted that into The Idiot Box.
Oh, wow.
And they basically had never really done live action before. So they just said, here's less than $1.50, but you can do whatever you want. So we had complete creative control. It was like the most fun I ever had.
Yeah,
so,
I can't imagine the flying gimp getting through.
Yeah, it was super violent.
What year was that?
91.
Oh, yeah, that's when they were still, yeah, yeah.
It was Liquid Television. There was nothing live action on MTV, and we were literally given complete free reign.
Well, that's like, that lasted, I think, about, that sort of era of freedom lasted probably like 10 or 12 years because, you know, Weird Al was saying when he would do Al TV, they would go, just give us 4 hours of programming. And he would just go make something and just hand them the tapes. And they'd be like, thanks. Like, no one checked anything.
Yeah. There was no S&P. Like, there's no standards of practices. Like, the shit we were doing was totally insane. And then they gave that VJ slot to Pauly Shore, and that became totally Pauly.
Oh, wow.
Oh, shit.
So that's what happened. And we ended up doing The Idiot Box. And then they came to us to do a season 2. And they literally, honestly, I don't think they actually paid us anything. So we were, like, losing money to make it. And we were like, we can't physically afford to do another season. So we turned that into Freaked, and that became Freaked.
Wow.
So Freaked was basically like an Idiot Box movie, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
And by then, Hollywood woke up to what we were doing and stopped us in our track. They were like, somebody woke up somewhere who smokes big cigars. We're like, what the? Squash.
Yeah, yeah. Who let that through?
What the hell is? Oh, my goodness.
Did you really feel that way, though? Literally, did you actually feel that way? Like, that Hollywood was like, wait a minute.
Oh, completely. I mean, you know, same thing happened with Freaked. We're like, I think they thought because I was in it and Keanu was in it, even though he's covered in hair, that they were somehow going to get a Bill and Ted style movie. And what we were doing was completely off the rails. And it was like Mad Magazine meets R. Crumb meets, you know, whatever, Zap Comics. And the sort of acid-fueled psychedelic comedy. It was basically an expensive cult movie. And we wrote it originally with the Butthole Surfers to do as a low-budget rock horror movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's how we wrote it with Gibby Haynes. Original Freak. Freak was originally written with Gibby, and it was written for the Buttholes. And we'd done a bunch of short films for the Butthole Surfers in those days. And we tried to get it made as like a $250,000, like Corman-style, you know, rock horror movie.
Yeah.
And everyone said no, so we repitched it to the heads of Fox, and it got $11 million.
Oh, my God. In
92. It was a lot of money.
Wow.
It was a lot of money. We were 25 years old, and we were just given complete creative free reign.
So that's probably like, I don't know, what, $30 or $40 million
now? Exactly. Yeah. You know, and it was a total psychedelic cult movie, and eventually, you know, somebody there woke up and was like, what in God's name are we doing? And it was like, you know, it was the era when Rupert Murdoch was trying to make more family-friendly fare at Fox. So I think somebody was like, oh, crap, we have to stop this immediately. Sure. So,
that's crazy.
And then coming off that project, did you feel... It's kind of like, ah, fuck, well, the jig's up. Or did you feel like, well, I don't know, I'll figure this out still?
Oh, not at all. I mean, the thing was, is like Tom and I had been working together for 9 years by then. So it was like we kind of both wanted to go do other stuff. So it was like, even during Freak, before that whole debacle happened, we were like, you know, this is like the apotheosis of the crazy stuff we do together, which had mostly been underground short films. So we'd never had this sort of, you know, agenda to kind of try to take it. We knew our stuff was too irreverent, that style, to do anything mainstream with. So for me, I wanted to like go and just work on my, I was really young. I wanted to go and just work on my writing and my directing. I started a commercial production company and started writing scripts and developing my voices on my own.
Wow.
So, it was actually a fantastic training ground. It was awesome.
So no wonder that with the advent of the internet, you were just probably salivating like, this is my home.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I belong.
I understand you people.
And you understand me.
You can flame me. I like you. I like being flamed.
Sitting alone naked, just smearing poop. I like it. I love the internet. I am home. How much stuff now do you do stuff online like as... Like, do you sort of have, like, a pseudonym, or do you make stuff, like, secretly?
I work mostly in mainstream. I mean, I do a lot of TV commercials, and I direct a lot of TV and a lot of different stuff. And
there's still money in TV commercials.
Yeah, there is. There's a lot of money in TV commercials, and there's great stuff going on in TV. And I write TV shows, and there's really great stuff. There's creatively, that's a great terrain. That's mostly where I'm at in terms of, you know, the day in, day out. The net, I'm a big believer... The one thing I never liked about celebrity for myself was I don't like the isolation. You know, I like riding subways. I like interacting with fans directly. So I'm completely open on the internet, like whether it's Twitter or Facebook or whatever. I'm like, people come to me like, how do I find you? I'm like, well, why don't you just type in my name and then, you know, and then send me an email.
Oh, my God. You and Keanu could not have taken more opposite paths
exactly.
in that sense.
So like, I don't like the disconnect. I've never felt comfortable with it. I like sort of just being in the trenches. So.
Do you ever talk to him and you're like, I'm riding a subway. And he's like, yeah, this isn't so great for me.
Exactly.
It was like the sad Keanu meme, like, guy can't even fucking sit down on a bench.
Yeah. Eat a sandwich.
To be fair, I mean, he's of all the, and maybe it's one of the reasons that we stayed close friends for so long. I mean, he's basically like my brother. He's one of my very best friends. And we go all over the place together. And it actually isn't as bad as you would think because he's pretty accessible in person. He's one of the only actors of that stature. I know quite a few that are, though. I mean, usually you get turned into Princess Di, and like your life is totally, you know, this weird bubble. You have no idea what the hell's going on.
Right.
And you have your handlers to rely on. But Reeves is not like that. And like, it's funny because I think I forced him to tell this story on Jimmy Kimmel. I'm not sure how happy he was. Jimmy's a friend. I was like, make Keanu tell you the Halloween story if he comes on. He made him tell it. But we were at a restaurant, and we walked into a restaurant in the West Village together a few years ago and forgot it was Halloween. And so we walked in at like 2 p.m, like to have a long lunch, and we just sat there and ate for like 6 hours. And when we came out, we were in the middle of the Halloween parade. Like surrounded by 40,000 fucking people, and like I was like, shit, what's gonna happen to Reeves? Like I felt bad, you know, and all that happened. Nobody paid us any attention at all, except for like one drunk guy who walked past and goes, "Look, it's two old fat guys trying to be Bill and Ted." And I'm not. That's the truth. That is not. I'm not making that up. That is verbatim.
Oh shit.
So there you have it.
That's well, great. I think commercials are, I find, pretty interesting because it's an industry where, you know, people are like, people are watching commercials, people are watching them. I go, yeah, but if they're good,
yeah,
people will watch them. Or people, you know, if people put up a good commercial online, then, you know, like on YouTube, then people will pass it around. Like, people just want to see good, funny things.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole idea of internet killing ads, and I think content in general is complete paranoia. I think that, unfortunately, the inverse is going to happen, where things are going to get so regulated that you're stuck watching ads in ways you may not want to online. But it's all going to get, it's going to be baked into the net just like it was baked into TV.
I don't think, you know, I just don't see pre-rolls being the wave of the future. I see, you know, yeah. I don't see like a fucking, you know, when I, as impatient, and I feel like I'm somewhat patient.
Yeah.
And I know most people are less patient, but to sit through a 30-second pre-roll ad on like a 4-minute video that,
yeah,
you're watching.
Yeah, no, you have to find other ways to get the ads in. I'm not saying they'll be exactly the way TV was. For sure they'll be different, but they're thinking of creative ways to infuse content with advertising, and that's not going to go away.
Right. I mean, it's. I think it's more branded content. I think it's, or I think it's, you know, like Palmolive presents
the way TV started.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that was it. They'll be. It's, and that is absolutely. That's happening with. That's how we sold Downloaded. I mean, like that's the way. You know, our movie's coming out. It was really important for me for it to have a digital life. So it's coming out theatrically, small, you know, art house theatrical, iTunes, CVOD. But then AOL is partnering up with VH1 and us, and we're doing a streaming rollout through AOL, which is really interesting. And that aggregates across all different kinds of portals. There's all different kinds of ways to see it that way.
God, I still am that idea of, you know, pre-internet bubble bursting, where it's just the fact that Napster raised more than $100 million, but just didn't really have a revenue model. We're like, well, I don't know. There's something here, you know. It's that time of the internet where people are
totally.
Like. Where they go, you could reach the entire world.
Yeah.
And then they do that flawed math. They go, all right, there's 6 billion people. If you could just get 1% of those people. And they're like, it doesn't really work.
But then the same thing happened with Twitter. Like, people never learn.
Yeah.
Then like 10 years later happened with Twitter. It was like, oh, this guy's got 4 million Twitter followers. Let's give him the movie. But nobody came. Where were his Twitter followers?
Yeah.
If even a third of those people came to the movie, we would have made our money back. What happened?
Yeah.
I hate hearing that. Like, I remember when I was working at E, like, you'd pass by a door and you hear, it's like, we have to cast him. You see how many Twitter followers he has?
Exactly.
Just like slunk down.
That worked for like 5 minutes.
You know what I mean?
That was like, you know, for the amount of time that Comic-Con was deciding which movies were being made.
Yeah. Right.
You remember that era?
It was
whatever they say, whatever those Comic-Con guys say, we got to do that.
It was Scott Pilgrim that kind of took it out, right? Because I remember that was like the one they were like, this is it. This is going to be huge at Comic-Con. Then everyone's going to see it.
And that,
then, like,
that year at Comic-Con was
and
insane.
And also, fuck you for not seeing that movie's amazing.
It's a great movie.
And that year at Comic-Con was insane because like the hotel we were in, like the Bayfront, I think, the Hilton.
The Hilton, yeah.
The entire goddamn side of the building was Michael Cera and the Scott Pilgrim.
I remember that year, yeah.
And I'm sure they must have just been like, you know, just like lions before a kill, they were like, guys, we are going to be billionaires. Yeah.
Let's drink up tonight because the battle's going to be easy tomorrow.
Sir, the first day reports are in.
What's that now?
Sorry.
What happened?
I must be hungover.
They must have been pirating it. That's what it was. They pirated it.
The internet.
Someone comes in and says, sir, the first day reports it. And he's like, all right, how much of a raise do I give the marketing department?
Yeah.
Let's see.
Fire the entire marketing department.
I guess I could bury a billion under a lake just to keep it there.
Yeah, I told you we should have used Ashton Kutcher in the lead. He's got 4 million Twitter followers.
No, you did it again.
But we're still sure Harry Potter hasn't turned a profit, right, bookkeepers?
God.
I want to know. I want to know about the Gate remake.
I have less to say on that because it's not in my hands at all. Oh, so it's like the producer of the original Gate. I've been working with him, and they're great people. They've made a lot of really big movies. But we're concepting a remake that would be as sort of subversive as the first one was, but for kids. Well, the first one was for kids too.
I love the Gate. It's like a really underrated movie.
Yeah, so. I love it too. And I love the sort of Amblin era of movies when they used to put kids in jeopardy. And I've got boys, and I can tell you they like those movies. So like, I think Abrams had a lot of balls doing that with Super 8. But there hasn't been too many movies like that in the last 20 years. I'd love to make one.
Yeah, I think the Jordan Vogt Roberts movie that just came out, Kings of Summer. That has the Amblin era. Like, yeah, he mentions that a lot too. Yeah. Just like, you know, these kids are drinking beer, they're smoking cigarettes. They get hurt. It's, yeah. That's what it should be.
And one that's kind of one that's sort of like nightmarish, the way Poltergeist or, you know, some of those movies were in those days, is something I would love to do. So hopefully they'll get the financing and I'll do it. But I'm pretty busy on other stuff, so we'll see what happens.
I remember scared the shit out of me when I was a kid.
This is a fucking great movie. And that's just great. All the practical effects are great. Yeah. And like there's an awesome GIF online that shows
the minions turning into the dead workman. It's amazing. With the foreground miniature work. It's
amazing.
Unbelievable.
It's amazing.
Well, that's Randy Cook who did Lord of the Rings. I mean, they had like you know, for a $3 million movie, they have like the greatest special effects minds working on it.
Yeah.
So by the way, I almost always, when I'm meaning to say Super 8, I almost always go, so when Abrams did 8mm, like, those are two totally different.
Yeah.
Those are not the same.
Don't send your fan base to that movie.
Yeah. Thematically, I jerked off the same.
Yeah. Oh, Matthew.
I'm sorry.
Matthew. Boo on both fronts. Boo on both fronts.
Yeah. Fair enough.
I remember when I saw 8mm in the theater, it was, I don't think, the intended reaction. There's this scene where Nicolas Cage at the end just has a breakdown because he just can't take it anymore.
Yeah.
He's just seen so much and he's gone through so much.
That's where I climaxed.
I mean, where he goes, he has one of those where he's like, no, and he does that, and the fucking full theater, and it's like everyone just burst out laughing. I don't think this is
the intended reaction.
I don't think that was
that reaction in every movie.
Yeah. He's got it. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's like Nicolas Cage making every choice.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
No!
Yeah.
So what do you, what's next? What do you want to,
Well, I'm working on another doc. I'm building another documentary right now about, children and show business, which is really fascinating.
Something
I know a little bit about. Yeah.
And,
so,
and by the way, good job for turning out normal. Like that is a real,
This movie's kind of about why that you have a slim chance in hell of that happening.
It's
to you.
Pretty crazy. Like when you really see, like, there's, there's almost this, do you remember that, Harrison Bergeron story? Where it's like everyone is basically equalized, and so people who are stronger are more like they're basically hobbled with all this weird stuff to keep them.
Yeah.
So I feel like as a child actor, you have all that stuff placed on you, and if you can somehow shake it off and get through, then you're actually kind of a super person for getting through that.
That's it. It's sort of like a video, like the hardest video game in the world, and you're supposed to develop at the same time.
Yes.
So try to do both of those things. It's pretty, it's like juggling, you know, chainsaws and kitty cats.
I don't know how it happens. You know. You must have had a good family.
Well, it takes a minute, but, you know. but that's what I'm working on. I'm working with the producers that did Undefeated, the doc from a couple years ago, and so I'm putting that together right now.
I bet college helped. Like going to college probably helped.
Yeah, and like, you know, having an interest. Like for me, I always had an interest outside of celebrity. So it wasn't. I was never really chasing that.
Yeah.
You know. So it was like I was grounded in other stuff. I never, like I said, when I was doing those movies, I was like, I had this sort of normal kind of like, you know, collegiate kind of home life. We were making stuff and it was fairly normal.
I feel so bad for Justin Bieber. I really do. Like he does.
I do too.
He doesn't know any better. Like when you're a kid and you're growing up and for X number of years, it's very easy. Like no matter what you do, people are like, that's the greatest thing ever.
Exactly.
And then at a certain point, they're like, that's the worst thing ever. And you're like, what am I? What did I do? Yeah. I don't know what I did different. Like he literally
that
like,
leather shirt.
No, I know that, but no one is there. No one is there telling. Like he doesn't have like a friend structure like you would have when you're growing up where someone's like, that is a stupid shirt. Why don't you take that off? Like everyone's like, hey, good job, JB. Hey, that's a pretty sweet shirt. So he just doesn't know. And you can see him in pictures now where he just, it's almost like he's trying to process the world because his paradigm has shifted.
Yeah.
And I just feel bad. And of course he's going to fucking start to go crazy.
Well, and also, you know, I feel my heart goes out to people like that are under that kind of scrutiny because at the point at which the public and the media turn against you, that's a very powerful force working against you. you.
Yeah.
So even if you have all the grounding in the world, that's a hell of a force to fight back against.
Well, imagine
you'd
being...
have to almost be able to say, "Okay, I quit. I'm leaving the business for a while. Screw all of you."
You have to imagine
and then come back.
You're in a relationship.
You should
for
go to NYU.
You're in a relationship
exactly.
for 4 years,
yeah,
or Brown, like Emma Watson.
Yeah.
Or you're in a relationship for 4 years, and for 4 years it's great. And there's not really any bumps, and the other person's like, "This is my soulmate." And then all of a sudden, one day, they're like, "Fuck you!" And you're like, "What happened? What happened? Yeah. I don't know what I don't yeah. touch me." You know, yeah. it's like on a dime.
Yeah, totally.
How could you wrap your mind
only
around
there's
that?
80 million of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's good. I'm yeah. and so is your take on it? Are you more of like, well, I'll just step back and kind of see how it plays out, or
well, again, sort of like the way I like to come at these stories is not, I try not to, you know, I'm not of the doc variety, and I like some of these movies, but I'm not usually like, you know, here's my opinion, I'm going to ram it down your throat for 90 minutes. I sort of like to look at the various sides of this thing. But I'm interested both in the present day, and I'm going to be following present day people around, but I'm also interested in just the history of like, when did little kids start working?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
what is the history of like, you know, and sort of that whole kind of look at capitalism and or the industrial age in terms of like when we started putting kids
like
to work.
Like even to the point of like, you know, like in the Industrial Revolution,
exactly.
like throwing them in the mills and
yeah.
stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. Going sticking back, in the chimneys.
Exactly. I'm going back to sort of, not for a long part of the movie, but I want to look at the Victorian era and then like, and vaudeville, which is really interesting. Yeah.
Hey, you're small. Fish those toxic chemicals out of that.
exactly.
I'll hold on to your legs.
Yeah, exactly. Little rascals. Like how all
no,
that
he broke
kind of,
off. All right. Yeah. There's more kids.
Whatever, next.
But I also think that there was, you know, certainly, you know,
all the little rascals turned out okay.
Yeah, you go talk to Robert Blake.
But the idea, you know, like in the Victorian era, where I even think it goes back to just an idea of a different approach to life and death, or a different mindset of life and death. I mean, even those, you know, I had a mini fascination for a while with the Memento Mori pictures of like the death pictures. Mm. Where because mortality rates were so high that it wasn't, you know, I mean, obviously, I'm sure people were sad, but it just seemed very much like, oh, yeah, well, some of us aren't going to make it
right,
to adulthood.
Yeah.
And even then, some of us aren't going to make it very far.
Yeah.
And so, you know, just taking pictures of just dead kids.
Yeah.
Like, well, this will keep them fair. So, you know, it's just the existential idea of what it means to be alive or dead, or that guy's a kid and, you know, like, throw him in there. I'm sure, you know.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like, one thing I want to look at, and I don't know how much you'll make it into the doc, is they end up being living processes and stuff gets thrown out. But what is a kid anyway? Like, when did we start calling kids kids?
Right.
Like, when did we decide that someone of a certain age, these little people, had their own kind of identity that ended at another certain point, which has a big part in once you get into the child actor world of like, and what you think they can handle developmentally.
Yeah.
So
can I pitch a sub story to that?
Sure.
It's the idea of with each successive generation, the extension of adolescence, like this idea that adolescence and teenager is
totally.
A thing
yeah.
and not like, well, once you hit puberty, you got to get married and start working because that's nature saying you're an adult now.
Yeah.
And then society going, well, it's 16. Well, it's 18. And
now
then,
it's 40.
You know, guys like, you know, guys like us, you know, 30s, early 40s. It's like, no, we're still like,
totally.
We're still, you know, like,
yeah,
that
we're even,
idea.
And we're even kidding ourselves anyway. I remember seeing This Is 40 and thinking they should have called it This Is 50. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
Judd Apatow isn't 40. He's 50.
Exactly.
Let's call a spade a spade.
Yeah, yeah.
This is about 50, guys. This is not about 40. the bar just keeps raising higher and
every
higher.
Year, it's always
I just
like that.
Always wanted to know what it was like being a 40-year-old billionaire.
Yeah.
Be so hey, his business isn't doing too good.
Yeah, I mean, I guess.
Sell your fucking Ferrari.
Yeah. I guess.
I like our record label's going to be okay. We got Ryan Adams. That's my favorite.
I guess it's the, you know, life expectancy extending, and maybe it has something to do with that.
Yeah, I also think it's pop culture. I think that it's, you know, our response to, you know, the age of gadgetry and, like, you know, the shock of the new. There's so many cool new things that and I think how society is responding to the digital and sort of tech revolution, too, is, I mean, I think it's scary, and it's also exciting, and you know, there's a...
It'll even itself out. It'll all give us cancer.
Exactly. We'll all be dead.
But psychologically, too, there's a, you know... Even in sort of Mad Men era, you look and you go, oh yeah, you know, at like 22, those people just took a job, and that was it.
Yeah.
And then they just kind of like,
completely,
this is my life.
Yeah, totally.
And so, you know, psychologically, something happens, and they sort of give up on that in a way, and then they're just, I mean, you know, you always look at old pictures, and you're like, hey, whoa, is that a 45-year-old woman? Mm. No, she's 19.
Exactly.
Is that a 50-year-old guy? No, he was like 22. Yeah. Like everyone just looks.
Yeah,
they
so
just
hard.
Look older and
22, 10 kids.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, it's the result of the beat in the 60s revolutions. You know, where you had the beat generation in the 60s. You had the sort of summer of love generation that just said screw it. You know, we're not going to follow that model. We're not going to grow up. I mean, the Merry Pranksters and all that kind of stuff kind of gave way. Once that connected with technology, like, all bets were off.
You know, you're right, because I think my great-grandparents on my mother's side are from Italy. I think my great-grandmother was like 15 or something when they got married and ended up having 11 kids.
Yeah, my grandmother was 16 when she got married.
And they just, like, all right, well, just...
Gross, guys, gross.
Yeah, there was a lot of teen banging going on, but they weren't,
Teen banging.
Teen banging.
Yeah. Which is your next movie after that.
I'm sort of folding that all into this one. It makes it more marketable.
It's that dangerous element you were talking about.
I'm making
about.
A very heady show business doc about teen banging.
Watch it.
I
put it right next to my copy of 8mm.
That's what the world's going to do. You're going to make me a very rich man.
I'm a child of the 80s, which was the apex of the teen sex comedy.
Right.
Of like Fast Times ushered in that,
completely.
Oh my God, they're like 15 and 16 years old and they're fucking and drinking.
We're all supposed to be having
science.
Sex.
Yeah,
and
completely.
I want to do those things.
Yeah, and like Lost Boys, it was identical to real life in every
just
way.
Just like it.
Oh, yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
Just like
we
it.
We were all studly swingers back in high school.
Who would swoop down and then
completely.
And destroy people.
Just turning things away.
Yeah,
but
as soon as you found like another young, hot guy moved into town, we got to make him a part of the fold.
Absolutely. Oil him up. Yeah. Give him some hair extensions. Slap some chaps on him.
Such a nice coincidence. He also rode a motorcycle.
It just all sort of worked out. He didn't need to ride anymore. He could fly at a certain point.
Yeah, but still, that wind in your hair at ground level is pretty cool.
Yeah.
No one flies that close to the ground whenever they develop flying.
Spoiler alert, one guy's the head vampire, and you don't see it coming.
He was the one guy without hair extensions, not to give it away.
That's right.
Yeah.
But he was really cool.
He was.
I always loved Bernard...
Herman.
What was that his name?
Oh, no, that's the composer.
Edward Herman was the guy, the head vampire guy.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert. And then Bernard Hughes.
Yeah.
Who was in, Mr. Merlin and Tron.
He was a theater
actor,
mostly.
He was in...
Yeah.
Who clearly, like, in the 80s, he became, like, if you needed a grisly old guy, he was your guy.
Yeah. He was great. The whole cast was... I mean, Joel Schumacher is known for, like, really... thinking outside the box casting, and that movie was Diane Weiss.
Diane Weiss
had this
amazing.
Crazy cast. Yeah.
Absolutely amazing.
So, it was fun.
Well, this was really great having you
fun.
On.
Thank you
so much. When is Downloaded available?
Downloaded will be out in theaters, some theaters, art house theaters at the end of June, and then iTunes, cable VOD in July, and then AOL in the fall.
And then Pirates Bay right now.
And then VH1 2014. And and torrent sites, if you email me, I'll get you the link.
And you are accessible online.
Yeah, I'm easily accessible online.
You got any invites left for Demonoid?
And please troll me. What's that?
You got any invites left for Demonoid, which is the torrent?
I'm just nodding, pretending I don't know what you're saying. so I don't get sued.
Still hanging on to your news groups.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're very IRC is still the place to go.
Cool. Thanks, Alex. Good to
Thank
see
you,
man.
Guys. Yeah, awesome.
Enjoy your burritos.
That was fun.
Cool.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Hulu Plus. Don't forget to sign up for your free trial of Hulu Plus and start watching your favorite hit shows right now. Go to HuluPlus.com/Nerdist, all lowercase, for your extended free trial. Again, HuluPlus.com/Nerdist.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.